This is All in Time, the title track from my very special guest Joanna Wallfish's album that was released last summer. We sat down right before that release to talk about the new album, also about her recent motherhood, her inspirations for music, and so much more. In this episode, you'll discover how her grandmother survived the Holocaust, literally by playing the cello. You'll hear us talk about being creative during lockdown, long-distance biking in the U.S., and Australia, and what it's like to come from a family of musicians. I had a great time talking with Joanna, and I hope you enjoy listening. Here's my conversation with Joanna Wallfish. Welcome to The Playful Musician. I'm your host, Steve Davidson. Each week, I sit down with musicians from all different paths, from composers to conductors, percussionists to piccolo players, to tease out their strategies, practice habits, tips, tools, tricks, routines, and how they keep all of it playful. The Playful Musician is an intimate look into the lives of each musician, how they got to where they are, what motivates and inspires them, and what playing music means to them. If you'd like to learn more about the guests or just more about being playful, head on over to the website, theplayfulmusician.com. There you can find show notes, links to all references mentioned in the show, and all kinds of resources related to music. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to The Playful Musician on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Overcast, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're at it, why not leave a review as well? Thanks again, and without further ado, here is this week's episode. Joanna, welcome to The Playful Musician. It's so nice to meet you.
It's great to meet you too. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. How are things in Los Angeles right now?
Oh, things are fine. I mean, it's been extremely hot.
Yeah.
But I managed to get out of the house at 6 a.m. this morning and enjoy the best of the day.
Nice.
Before we met this morning. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
No smoke down in Southern California?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet. But we, you know, every summer there's always that anticipation of when the wildfires begin.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had, I'm north of you, so I'm in Southern Oregon. And, we have some fires, unfortunately. So we've had a little bit of smoke, but
yeah,
it's actually been a pretty nice summer. So how long have you been in Los Angeles?
I moved here in 2017. Yeah, it's funny. Everywhere that I've moved to has always been initially an experiment for like, I'll just go for a month.
Yeah.
2 months. And yeah, it's been... This is the longest I've lived somewhere as an adult, I think, at this point. Like, I lived in New York for almost this long, but LA, yeah, since 2017. I came for 3 months, I sublet my apartment in New York, and then after a little while, I thought I have to, it's all or nothing at this point, so.
Right.
So here I am.
Awesome, awesome. And you have a new recording out, All in Time, or it's about to be released, and tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, this album All in Time will be my sixth record that I've released, and it was sort of also an accident. You know, I after making my album in 2019, Far Away From Any Place Called Home, I was like, never again. I cannot face making another album. It's too expensive, too much work, emotion,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. But during the whole 2020 lockdown time, I did a lot of songwriting. And then In 2021, I became pregnant, and that's when I was like, okay, I have to make another album because I don't know if I'll ever make music again. Or, you know, I don't know if I'll ever have time to do something creative again. When there was the prospect of becoming a mom, there was this enormous sense of urgency to produce new music and have something out there again. So, and this album, it's a collection of songs that, you know, there's no particular theme, like unlike my previous records, but there is definitely an overarching sense of purpose about the record. Like the title All in Time is about letting myself be more patient with creating good things and letting good things come, and that kind of really came out of the pandemic experience and then the pregnancy experience and becoming a mother and all those things. Yeah. So this record is, I feel like, all about, all at once, about nothing and everything.
That's so cool. I patience. do you That's a really hot topic for me. I do the dance with patience. Do you feel you're a patient person mostly?
No, not even a little bit. I would say I'm a pretty impatient person when it comes to wanting to experience things. Like growing up, you know, if it was my birthday next week, I would insist on having my presents today. And, you know, I never wanted a surprise. I just wanted to know things right now. So if I knew something was on the horizon, I would become very impatient about getting to it. But I suppose when the lockdown began and I sort of really bedded into that lifestyle of stillness, and I just took things off of the horizon. I just sort of, in order to, for my own self to like stay a little bit sane and level-headed, I needed to just stop planning ahead or even having a desire for something to happen, which is kind of, that is such an extremely different way to my usual self, which is like always creating something, always making something happen. But it was pretty useful for me to practice that, like, well, tomorrow there might be something or maybe not, and that's okay. Because it's, it's given me a sense of calm where before I had a sense of real anxiety about what if, when, now, you know, all those sort of like things that you can't control, but you're trying to control.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, well, I can't control them, so I'm just not going to try.
Sure. That's very wise. That's a great realization. And then, the time piece. So with, you know, One Wish kind of really hones in on that, the one track. Can you speak about that a little bit? That track and how it relates to time.
Yeah, that's absolutely. That song was actually written in a really interesting situation. It must have been May-ish 2020, so like a month into everything. And I was speaking with a very good friend of mine, Maura Smiley, who's a wonderful vocalist, composer. And Maura had set up this really fun thing with friends where we would get onto a Zoom meeting for an hour and we'd, you know, say hi, and then everyone would mute themselves and practice. So it was like witness practicing.
Oh, wow.
So that everyone, it was like to keep one another on track for whatever creative endeavor they're trying to pursue. And we wouldn't hear about what each other were doing. It was just sort of like, okay, great, we're here, bye. And you could sort of sometimes in the squares, like, see someone playing their guitar or someone like scribbling down or some notes or something. So I actually wrote this song during these silent Zoom meetings with Maura. And yeah, it was really fun. And basically I started reflecting on my grandmother, who's in London. She just turned 98.
Wow.
And because I had no idea when I could go home. Like, I live in America, but I'm not American. So like, there was also a lot of issues with travel at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew I could go home, but I also knew I wouldn't be able to come back because of all the lockdowns and the closed borders and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't a citizen. So I just sort of was reflecting on the fact that I had no concept of when I would see my family again. And I've never experienced that in my life. My family are all musicians. I've always been very used to everyone traveling a lot, or we're all now just spread around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been okay because you could just hop on a plane and go home.
Yeah.
But now I couldn't. So, and because I was in this like Groundhog Day, we all were this Groundhog Day of lockdown.
Yeah.
And suddenly a week has gone by, suddenly 3 weeks has gone by, and what has happened? And in Los Angeles, in case you've never been here, it's always sunny, which kind of drives you mad because there's no distinction on
seasons.
Like, oh, today was sunny, yesterday was rainy. Do you remember last week when it hailed? There's no like punctuation,
mm-hmm.
Which really can play with your mind. So this song, One Wish, was all about, you know, the opening lyric, please can we slow down time because it's running too fast and I can't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you a note in the post, let the words trail behind in the wind. I'll be listening with pen ready. And I can't remember the rest of the lyrics because I'm not singing it. Yeah, and so I was just sort of dreaming about my grandma, and I started writing her letters. That was the other thing.
Oh.
I thought, you know, put pen to paper, send letters, because it's so nice to receive a letter.
Yeah, an actual letter.
Yeah, and I was also sending postcards with my great aunt, my grandma's sister. Yeah, so that was the beginning of that song.
Nice. So you're talking about your grandma, Anita, is that her name?
Anita, yeah.
Anita, mm-hmm. Yeah. And she played the cello, or does she still play?
No, she stopped playing a little while ago. But yeah, she played the cello her entire life.
Wow. And she was, she's a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, my grandma has had a really... I don't even know what the right adjective is. Extraordinary, crazy, unfortunate, fortunate
mm-hmm.
life. But yeah, she was born in Germany as a Jew. And she had two older sisters. She was the youngest. And yeah, in the Second World War, my grandma, she was studying the cello in Berlin. Her parents had sent her to a teacher in Berlin, and actually she was in Berlin the night of Kristallnacht when the Nazis came in and smashed all the windows and when it became very, very clear that Jews were in incredible danger. I mean,
yeah.
I know my grandma's parents already knew that, but as my grandma has described in her book, she has a book called Inherit the Truth. And she talked about her father as an eternal optimist. You know, he was always really, yeah, optimistic that it would be okay, and or when it was clear that it was not going to be okay, that they would somehow escape and be able to leave Germany. And my grandma's oldest sister, Mariana, she did manage to leave. She went to what was then just Palestine, and then ended up in England, actually, and survived the entire war. She worked as a carpenter through that time. But my grandmother and her sister went through the entire hellish experience. My great-grandparents were murdered by the Nazis, and My grandma and her sister were arrested and were in a prison for about 18 months before then being sent to Auschwitz. And they were separated. My great aunt went to Auschwitz first, and as far as my grandmother knew, that would be the end of their story. Yeah. And then when my grandma was taken to Auschwitz, in the time that they were being selected and lined up and everything and shaved and tattooed, one of the guard that was with my grandma that tattooing her, and happened to ask, she said, you know, what did you do before all this? And my grandma, who was, I think, 15, 14 or 15.
Oh,
at the
my
time,
gosh.
I know, just a child. She said, oh, I played the cello. And this guard, who I think was also a prisoner, it was, you know, all these prisoners had different roles. If you were lucky enough to survive, you had a job, or you had a job which would help your survival. Yeah. Anyway, this guard said to my grandmother, wait here, you will be saved, and handed her a toothbrush. And this guard went and got a woman named Alma Rose, who was the conductor of this band that played in the camp. So there was a women's orchestra in the camp, and it was made up of accordionists, violinists, recorder players, you know, any instrument there was, but there was no cellist. And so my grandmother became the cellist in this band. And that was the reason she survived that particular concentration camp. And she also reunited with her sister in Auschwitz, because when my grandmother was younger, she had a pair of shoes that she painted and put new shoelaces on. There's a long story about that, but anyway, that particular pair of shoes that Renata was wearing was on the top of the pile. Or maybe it's the other way around. No, my grandmother was wearing those shoes. They were on the top of the pile of shoes. Renata said, those are my sister's shoes. And then they were reunited in the camp.
Wow.
And because of my grandmother's elevated, in quotes, status as cellist in the orchestra there, she also was able to help her sister survive. Her sister had a very rough time, as they all did, but it's all relative. They were sent after, when the Nazis knew that their time was ending, they sent a lot of the prisoners out to a different camp called Belsen Camp, which was just a terrible pit, basically, where people just starved to death, which my grandmother and great aunt were sent to. But then they survived when the British Army came and liberated them. And eventually they went to England, and my grandmother became a career cellist, a founding member of the English Chamber Orchestra. She played in the Pitt Orchestra for West Side Story for 20-odd years, and has just been the most inspiring musician as far as I've ever known of her, and to so many people. So yeah, music. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, like, I wouldn't be here talking to you now. It always makes me think how music in my family has always been so much more than a career. It's been this, like, if it weren't for music, none of us would exist.
Right. That's so powerful.
That's pretty crazy.
What an inspirational story, and what an inspirational woman. Like, how fortunate for you to have such a woman in your life.
Yeah, I do feel very fortunate, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, if I was, you know, my grandmother would shake off, like, oh, I'm not inspirational. You know, she's very matter of fact and no fuss, and talk about patience. She has zero patience. But honestly, I think that is really an enormous part of her survival, and the reason why she did survive is because she's, in her character, she's so blunt and has no time for messing around, and and she's very, very clever. And she's multilingual. She speaks German, French, now English, because she moved here as a young woman. Here, there, moved to England as a young woman. And has tons of chutzpah. You know, she just gets things done and takes no crap from anyone.
Awesome. Let's listen to a little bit of this track from the album. This is entitled Praying Mantis.
Swept tapestry so delicate and sweet. And you, are you alone with just a single knitting needle, trying to weave your way across the sands of time? And we, are we just waves down beneath a soaring eagle in an ocean made of secrets that would drown before they ever reach the land?
So you're a mom now. When did you become a mom?
On the 14th of April, 2022 at 4:52 p.m.
So you have a toddler.
Yeah, that was the moment I met my girl. Pardon?
So you have a toddler now.
Yeah, she's almost 16 months old, which is amazing.
Yeah.
She is the most, talk about inspiring people. She is the most inspiring person to me. Every day I'm like, wow, you're just so cool. Let's go do things.
That's awesome. How is that shifting, or how do I want to say this? So a lot of the parents I know talk about like how their concept of time drastically changed once they had a child. Are you experiencing that as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, I wasted so much time beforehand. I mean, the number of Pulitzer Prizes I could have won by now, and, you know, novels I could have written and films I would have directed. I mean, what is amazing about having a child is you realize that time is incredibly stretchy and long. Like one day, I usually wake up at around 5:30 or 6 with her. And, you know, and the day ends around 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. by going back to sleep. And, but that day, it can fit in so many different, not just activities, but so many different, I have to fulfill so many different roles in a single day.
Right.
From getting up and being mom, you know, changing her diaper, getting her dressed, brushing teeth, making breakfast, cuddling, reading, whatever it is. And then I'll go and do the role of me, which is I'll probably go swimming. My husband will take her for an hour and I'll go swimming, which is my daily sanity maintainer.
Yeah.
And then I'll play the role of teacher. I'll go and teach my teaching job, teaching songwriting and sort of nurturer to these young adults who are pursuing a career in music. And then I will have a rehearsal for my own music. So I'm in the role of professional musician in my own right. And then I'll be in the role of like job search, a person. Meanwhile, I'm always being her mom, and chef and house cleaner and wife and, you know, daughter, call my parents up and you know, and it's not even noon.
Yeah.
right. So, yeah, I mean, there are so many things. And the other thing I've been thinking about this week is a friend of mine called me up the other day and she was like, oh yeah, hi, I just wanted to chat because I'm bored. And I was like, that's totally fair and I love to chat with you, but I haven't been bored. I definitely haven't been bored since I had my daughter. Like, there's no room for boredom. There's definitely a lot of room for scratching your nails, you know, against the wall, like this feeling of like, it's another version of Groundhog Day as well. Like, there is a relentlessness to it. There is an incredible exhaustion, but also with that exhaustion, it's like everything is very raw and clear. I think, yeah, it's a lot of paradoxes being a parent. Like, there's incredible focus and incredible blurriness at the same time.
Wow.
I can only do what's right in front of me. I'm not very good anymore at like thinking beyond in the moment. So I guess why Zen masters are able to stretch time, because the emphasis is on being in the moment.
Right.
And I suppose that's what I experience in the good moments. That's what I experience. This like, and this infinite time within an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. My girlfriend and I talk about it a lot, like how you'll have some days that just seem to drag on. Like, you're just like, this day will never end. And then you have other days that it's like you blink and you're like, it's time to go to bed. Like, how did that happen? And as I get older, I'm going to be 55 this year. It seems to happen. It's probably happening just as much as it did when I was 18, but I'm just more attuned to that elasticity of time. You know, Einstein talked about it too. Like, scientists have talked about it too. I don't know. I also find myself tied to numbers a lot. Like, I'm an athlete, so I'm looking at numbers all the time. I have a day job, so I'm looking at the time. Like, I'm always, there's just always this reference to these numbers, which are sort of artificial in a way. Like, we invented it. We invented the clock. We invented this way to like keep track of it, but it's not, there's an artificiality to it. And on the weekends, on the days when I don't have to do that, it's just interesting, the whole time thing. I'm really fascinated by it these days.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's funny you mentioned about being an athlete and looking at numbers. I went swimming early this morning, and I swim on a swimming team, and a woman on the team at the end of their workout looked at her Apple Watch and looked at the numbers and got out. Great, done and dusted, did what I came to do. And I got out, I'd managed to swim 1600 meters, mm-hmm. and I got out early before the workout was over because I was tired, my shoulders hurt. And I'd done enough, like, but it's sort of both things. It's like, for me, if I can get to a mile, then that's like my minimum allowance.
Yeah.
Before I'm like, if I want to go further, I'll go further, but I don't have to at this point. but it's a funny thing. And then another thing that comes to mind is like when I've done long, other long endurance things like bike touring and things like that, where I would have my odometer telling me how many miles I've been and how many miles I have to go. In order for me to get through those incredibly long days, I would just need to tell myself, like, I've got 60 miles to go, which is kind of an impossible amount of miles to really conceive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's so far, and I can't possibly keep going that far. So I would actually just tell myself that by 6 o'clock tonight, if I just keep going, I will have gotten there, set up camp, and had a shower. Like, that sort of more loose sense of like, instead of like in an hour or 60 miles left, or if I keep doing my rotations, or so sort of painting bigger, broader brushstrokes of that sense of time.
Yeah.
And then thinking of labor, like actually giving birth, that's a that I think is for me definitely my most extreme need of my extreme experience of needing to know, or my let's see, it really showed up how much I hold on to needing to know how much time is left,
right,
of a thing. Because when you're in extreme pain,
yeah,
you don't know, could I, can I keep going with this pain? And but in birth, you cannot know,
right?
You cannot know anything. You there, so like, to practice just giving into it. Oh,
yeah.
Well, it's nigh on impossible.
A surrender,
you know, but there is also a sense of inevitability. So I think with everything in life, like, you, if you just keep going, you will arrive.
Right.
So yeah. It's like, how can, but you know, can you bear down and keep going or not?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're, I mean, when you first reached out to me and I was, learning about who you were, and I was really touched and inspired, because you do endure, like, you, so you've had these, you know, you did your song cycle and twice, doing an incredibly long distance on the bicycle, self-supported, and the documentary, which, listeners, if you haven't seen it, it's well worth seeing. I'll put a link to it. It's gorgeous and just real inspiring. I mean, I've always been I love, like, real life adventure stories. I've read, like, about Shackleton and who's the guy who lost his arm? A climber. Like, I'm just fascinated by what.
Oh, the one who fell into the canyon.
Exactly, and the rock. Ugh,
yeah.
Like, I'm always, and there's another one about these two guys. Two climbers into the void. Anyway, those stories fascinate me, because I'm like, what we're capable of, I don't really know that we are aware of what we're capable of, but I read these stories about people that survive or that endure. It's super inspiring, and it challenges me. That's one thing I like about cycling. I'm an avid cyclist and endurance athlete, and it's a way to push myself and to really touch the edges of those boundaries. And that was, yeah, it's just inspiring to me, because that shows up for you in a lot of ways. Like, you're creating art, and then physically with your cycling, and now, you know, being a parent, being a mom, I mean, all of those things are awe inspiring to me, because I'm not a parent. I will never be a mom for sure. Have that experience, but yeah, you have a lot of that enduring and endurance throughout your whole life, and that's just super inspiring to me.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, hearing you also, you know, describe the things that you love and the kind of books you've loved to read. Yeah, I'm the same. I've read a lot of those books, and also I'm obsessed with reading about cold water swimming and things like that.
Oh.
And because I love cold water swimming.
Nice.
But yeah, I think you're right. As a human being, a physical being, we're capable of almost anything physically, like forget about machinery and technology and, oh, we can fly a plane. That's not even so impressive as, you know, look at, you know, a Cirque du Soleil acrobat or a synchronized swimmer. I mean, my goodness, I'm an obsessive swimmer, and I know a lot about being underwater, and I'm incredibly comfortable underwater and powerful and strong. But when I look at a synchronized swimmer doing what they do, and the breath holding and things like that, I mean, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
With swimming as an example, I've always loved swimming in wild waters, you know,
open
if I'm
water.
On a hike and I see a pond that's deep enough, like that's knee deep, I'll jump in, or a glacial lake on top of a mountain, or, and I grew up in England, so like English people are pretty stoic when it comes to weather and coldness, and like it's raining, well, we'll still go swimming outside or hiking,
yeah,
because you get to go to the pub and warm up afterwards. But I do remember I was in Cornwall volunteering as a chef for a music festival years ago. And in this idyllic paradise situation that, you know, the kind of cottages are clinging to the cliffs, and you would walk out and jump into the sea, and it was cold. It was cold and rough and wild and amazing. And I would be in that water 3 or 4 times a day. And I remember I was always trying to get people in, like, come on, let's go swimming. Let's go swimming. And I dream about this place almost every other night as well. And I'm always saying, come on, everyone, let's get in the water. But I remember one time trying to convince this girl to get into the water, and she didn't want to. And every day I would try again. Come on, it's only cold. I would say, it's only cold. You'll warm up. It's only a moment, and then you'll be warm again. Again, yeah. The sense of time, like for a few minutes, you'll have this sensation, and then that sensation will change back to comfort again.
Yeah.
And, They just went for a bike ride as well.
Oh, nice.
That's my bubby.
So sweet.
I know. And anyway, but I remember making this person cry because I was so overbearing with my enthusiasm, and they just didn't want to. They were like, Joe, I do not like to be cold. I do not want to go swimming. Just stop. And that taught me a bit of a lesson that, like, I guess not everyone likes the same stuff.
Yeah.
And also, it's totally fair. Not everyone likes to be uncomfortable. And I think I really like to be uncomfortable in certain ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in ways that I know I can be reversed. Like, you get cold, just as long as you have all the tools to warm up afterwards, you have your flask of hot water, your jumper, some sweet biscuits, and a hat.
Yeah.
And you will, I mean, I find that water is instant transformation for me. Like, if I'm grumpy, I will go stick my head under the hose and I will be fine again, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And probably the same for you. Like, you get on your bike for half an hour.
Yeah.
And you've been like moving at a different pace. You're suddenly the world sparkles again. I think that's what it is. It's like you see, it's like it turns the lights back on when you get out of your chair, off your phone, out of the clock mentality, and you see the world brighten again.
Yeah. Yeah. My girlfriend, she's like, you know, there'll be times where she's like, don't you think you ought to go for a bike ride? Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it definitely, being outdoors, for me is as much for my mental well-being as it is for my physical. And there's nothing personally for me other than probably playing music. Like, music couldn't do that for me too. And it takes a shorter amount of time than cycling. But a 4-hour bike ride for me, there's almost nothing better, because that amount of time for me is like the chatter in my head kind of, it's like a little kid who just wears themselves out, you know, having kind of a tantrum or just whatever it is. My brain will do that, and then it's run out at the end of the 4 hours. So it's like, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I've often talked to people, or people have asked me, people who are, you know, not long-distance swimmers or cyclists or whatever, that often is the question of, like, don't you get bored? Like, I've done these long bike trips, and you wake up at 6, you get on your bike by 7, you get off your bike by 7. So it's like 12 hours of cycling every day for 2 months.
Yeah.
Or I can easily swim for an hour and a half. I don't wear headphones, you know, and I don't listen to music on either activity.
Sure.
And when I run, I don't listen to music. Or when I go walking, I don't listen to music. And no, it's true. There is this, I remember, actually, when you said your brain running out, there was a part of the West Coast on Pacific Coast Highway just north of
Mendocino?
Yeah, just north of Mendocino. And it was this very, very windy, narrow, hilly section and foggy. And I was cycling. And I suddenly realized that I hadn't had a thought all day.
Wow.
I was like cycling. And then the thought occurred to me that I had not been thinking all day. And it was kind of like, wow, I think I've cracked it.
That's awesome.
I think I've arrived.
That's so cool. Yeah. That's so cool.
Because you're just in your body, right? You're just like breathing, moving, seeing, smelling. You're back to animal, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I think we are so extremely removed from that. Even for me living in Los Angeles, you ask me, how's LA? Well, LA is many things for me personally and other people, different things too. But what I do struggle with in Los Angeles is that you have to drive everywhere.
Right. In the car.
You can bike. I've tried cycling, but it's so dangerous and it's so polluted because it's a car city. So like you're just choking on fumes all the time. And so I miss living in an urban environment where I am still connected. Like in New York, you're walking everywhere. You're on the stinking subways. You're eye to eye with strangers all the time.
Yeah.
Same in London, same in Paris, all these other places. And even though it's an urban city, fast and furious situation, there is still the possibility to access that sense of, sensational life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here I do other things. I mean, I drive to a hiking trail and then I hike all day.
Yeah.
But I would love to just, you know, get rid of my car.
Yeah. I can relate. Ashland, where I live, is very walkable. It's a very small, it's a mountain town. And that's one of the things we love is that we don't have to drive very much at all. And we talk about moving a lot, like, because it's very small, which is good. And it's has its pluses and minuses, obviously. And the minus is that it's not very diverse. It's also, there's not a lot going on musically, you know, it's not like a Seattle or Los Angeles or New York with a lot of art and the opportunity to see world-class musicians or be exposed to that. But every time we go to a big city, like we were just in Vancouver, BC, which is a beautiful city. I love that city. But our friends who live there, they're also mostly car bound. Like they're like, we're going to go pick strawberries and we're going to drive, you know, 40 minutes to go to the strawberry patch, or we're going to go do this thing. We're going to drive 30 minutes. And that's, we got back home and we're like, yeah, we have it really good. Like we have to like be in our car all the time, which I'm very grateful for. And I have, you know, literally 5 minutes out my door, I'm in the woods. So I'm really blessed in that way.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I've been to Ashland once before.
Really?
And I have a few friends. Yeah, people, some of my colleagues who I sing with in LA are from Ashland.
Huh. Small world. Wow.
It is a small world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you should come up and do a concert sometime. That would be super fun.
Well, they have the Shakespeare Festival, and also right before or after, they have a whole music festival on that same, is it the Green
it's
stage?
Called the Green.
I applied a few years ago.
Yeah, it's called the Green Show. And actually, we were just there two nights ago and heard these wonderful guitarists, local guitarists. There's also the Brit Music Festival, which happens during the summer out in Jacksonville, Oregon. And then there's some little venues. There's the Siskiyou Institute, which puts on little jazz shows. They capture a lot of people that are going up I-5 from like San Francisco to Portland or Seattle. And then there's a winery that's been doing some shows. So there's a few things. But I want to talk about Song Cycle, but before that, I want to get back to the album, because you said there's really not a theme, and I would maybe disagree slightly, because I think water is definitely an overarching theme, and you were just talking about your relationship to water and open water swimming, which is I'm also a fan of. I go to Costa Rica almost every winter, and that's one of the things I love the most is being in the ocean and just feeling that. But there's such a watery, I don't know how else to say it, watery feel or, yeah, I don't know how else to put it with the album, but it definitely feels like water a lot throughout the whole album. And that's
funny. You're the second person to say that, actually. I played it to a friend of mine called Lisa. She's a wonderful person in LA and a publicist, and I sent it to her. And she was like, Joe, I've been listening to your album, and I've been trying to figure out what it is. There's something about it. And then I just realized it felt like I was underwater the whole time. But not like drowning and
right,
like,
right,
help
right.
me, help me. But just like in this water world.
Definitely.
Which is cool. And actually, I chatted with someone else the other day who... so the record's out on a German record label called Galileo Music. And I had a radio interview in Germany on Zoom a couple of days ago. And the interviewer was saying that it sounded like paintings, that each song was like a painting, which also has that fluid, which I really appreciated too, because I my undergrad was as a painter and I have that in me too. But I appreciated that feedback as well, because I hadn't thought about either of those things. I had not intended it for it to sound watery or painterly, but
yeah,
these two things are fundamental to my expression.
Yeah.
And, you know, I teach songwriting at LA College of Music, and my students are constantly trying to figure out what genre they're in. Mm. And I am too, you know, because everyone likes to put boxes around things. And honestly, I don't know anymore. The more music I make, the less sure I am about what genre it is. But the more it seems the more unapologetic my style seems to become. As far as me just harnessing my personality, which is this water, I don't know, water nymph creature.
And here's one more track from Joanna. This one is Desert Wind. Talk a little bit about your songwriting process. Like do you get ideas when you're swimming or out on the bike, or where does the idea stem from? Is it like you hear like a melody first, or are you hearing lyrics, you hear a bass line, or is it all over the place? Like
it really is all over the place. I could tell you how every individual song began.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one song I've ever had an idea for on a bicycle, and that was for my Song Cycle album, and that's this song called Road Trip.
Mm-hmm.
But, and Ballet of Birds too, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But for this record, I mean, ideas come and go very quickly for me. Like, I can go months without writing anything, and then I write a lot all of a sudden very fast. But if I have an idea while I'm swimming, there is no way that idea will have stayed, because if I start having an idea in lap 10, by lap 30, my mind, like you said, I have no thoughts left.
Yeah, yeah.
So I cannot, like, sometimes I thought about getting, like, waterproof paper and marker and, like, having it at the end of the pool and, like, script. But I did that once and then gave up, you know, didn't.
Yeah.
So, but, like, for instance, a song like All in Time.
Yeah.
The title track of the album, All in Time. I was sitting in my living room. It was August. I had just found out I was pregnant. It was like 3 days after I'd done all the tests and was like, oh my God, This is actually happening. And I was crying because I was scared. You know, it's like something I've wanted my whole life. And now I'm like, oh no, this is terrifying. And I remember there was the light in, it was my old house, and in the afternoons, the light would shine in a very beautiful way through the windows. There were two windows at right angles to each other. And there was the shard of light pouring in onto the wooden floor. And so I sat in this pool of light and I just started writing. I guess, yeah, I think I got my guitar out and I retuned it. I tuned the D string to a C. I don't know what that tuning is called. It was sort of, I'd like to do it, random tunings just to like shake my inspiration up.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it was very much, I just closed my eyes, like my face was all sticky from tears, and I started noodling on the guitar, and I just started singing the song. So very often I'll go so long without ideas, but I think I'm absorbing ideas without necessarily being conscious of it.
Yeah.
And then when the muse strikes, she strikes really hard, and it's like, then I just sing the song like it was already there. So I think I just started singing, you know, whisper sweet silence in the darkest room, keeper of life itself as it softly blooms. Because that was my meditation on what was happening in my room at that moment. And yeah. So I wish, it's one of those things, like if you aim a ping pong ball like 100 yards away into a cup and you get it in. It's like you couldn't do that twice.
Right.
that's kind of how my songwriting process has become. Like I couldn't write that song if I tried. I just had to wait for it to be right.
Right.
What an annoying answer. I can't teach my students that.
Right. So what do you, I was going to ask, like, what do you tell your students about, like, do you advise them to have like a practice where they sit down and like, okay, write 10 melodies or write some lyrics or that kind of thing?
I like to, you know, I like to really encourage my students though, to actually just walk through the world awake. A lot of my students are trying to write pop songs.
Yeah.
In quotes, like whatever the hell that means anymore.
Yeah.
There's a lot of generic songwriting, a lot of like, you know, that melody is like Taylor Swift's latest hit. Did you know that? Are you aware of that? Like, so honestly, a lot of, while I'm teaching, you know, music theory, like language, grammar, like how to, different rhyme schemes, like all the sort of theoretical stuff and practical stuff, a lot of the way that I love to coach my students is more like, I'll encourage them to go exercise, you know.
Yeah.
I'll say like, okay, in the next hour, what I want you to do is leave your phone in your locker, take a notebook and go walking and just write down everything you see. There's a wonderful book by Rick Rubin that is relatively new called The Creative Way. And the whole book just talks about how the fact that there is creativity everywhere and there is, oh, little bubba. There is the potential
You are you okay?
Yeah, no, she's just okay. Tired.
We'll be done soon.
No, it's fine. She's not on her own. Her dad's with her. They'll be fine.
Yeah, okay.
So Rick Rubin talks about how there is the potential to be a creative everywhere and anywhere.
Yep.
And you don't have to think even like, it's like, you don't have to be a musician to make music. You don't have to be an artist to make art.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be alive.
Right.
And awake. And see things. So I really try and sometimes it's very trying. Because also the generation of people that I'm teaching, they've never not had access to the internet or phone or social media.
Right.
You know, they're sort of between the ages of 18 and 24.
Yep.
And I didn't even have a phone. I think I had a pager, and then like, I think I got my first flip phone when I was 24.
Yeah, same.
So I'm having to sort of like, yeah, I try and take my songwriting teaching from the angle of being experienced detectives. Like, I don't know. There's so much to experience and there's so much art to see in the way the light comes through the trees and the way the truck sounds in a puddle and, you know, And if they just, often I'll have lyrics that just sound like any old lyrics, but if they tell me what they're trying to write about, then suddenly things will happen. Mm. So I encourage them to either just free write and journal or record a conversation they're having with a friend about stuff and then transcribe that or, I don't know.
Nice. Love it.
Yeah.
Song cycle. So this is like... The first thing, other than the track that you sent me, which I think was Praying Mantis. I can't remember if it was that or All in Time, the first thing that you sent me. But that made my heart leap. But also when I saw that you were a cyclist, I was like, oh, this is so awesome. Like, I resonate with that so much. And then, yeah, talk a little bit about song cycle. And it, specifically, I was thinking, like, what... Can you tell me what was the most challenging aspect about that for you? Was it the physical or the mental, or was there some other, like, I'm just curious. Oh. Do we need to take a pause or okay.
I think they're okay.
Okay.
So what was the most challenging aspect of the Great Song Cycle? The first song cycle tour I did from Portland to LA, I think the most challenging of that one was probably the physical, because I'd never done anything like it. Well, I had. I'd done some bike trips for fun, but never like combining music and cycling.
Right.
But
it's just so, there were, just there so everybody like, knows, like, she did a tour, like, did show, not only did she cycle her bike from Portland to LA, but she also booked shows and took her guitar, like, did the whole nine, right? It's like, just imagine, just ride your bike from Portland to LA. Okay, that's enough, but that's not all. She actually did a tour with... And perform, like, I don't know how that's so freaking amazing. Like, gonna ride 60 miles, gonna shower, and then perform, and then do that all over again. So just to set the context.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is what I did. But the first one of its kind in, you know, Oregon and California, the gigs were relatively small. I played in coffee shops, house concerts, one jazz club, some spontaneous last minute bookings, like San Luis Obispo. I played in a cafe that was sort of last minute. And And I didn't do that many shows. It was like 5 weeks on the road, and I think I did like 16 shows or something. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, that, so the physical aspect was hard. I mean, there was one day that was scary, because it was so hot, and it was one of those days where I was like on the highway, crawling up this endless hill, like heat mirages. And
yeah.
I remember stopping, and there was nowhere to go. There was just like four lanes of traffic, me, and then some scrubland. It was just like bushy, scrubby stuff. And I remember this car going by, and there was a couple in the car, and the woman in the passenger seat had her feet, bare feet, up on the dashboard, up against the window. And I remember I looked back and I saw them going up, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I just remember this moment of like, I wonder what she's thinking. Like we're in such different universes right now.
Yeah.
And that was definitely, I was considering in that moment of like, just like piling myself into the bushes and sleeping there, but it was only like 11 a.m. Oh God, I got so far. Anyway, that was definitely one of my, by 6 o'clock, I will be wherever I'm trying to get to. So yeah, the first tour was the physical thing, but the fitter I got as the weeks went by, the easier it got. And then the end of the tour was very devastating in a way, because yeah, it was over. This life-changing experience had come to an end.
Yeah.
But the second one that I did in Australia, which was from Brisbane all the way to Hobart, 2,500 miles,
jeez.
That one was really the big challenge for me, was the mental aspect, because I was a little burnt out emotionally by the time I embarked on that tour. I was in a different stage of my life. I was getting kind of despondent about my career, to be honest, even though I had a book published, I'd written a memoir about my Great Song Cycle trip through the USA, which had been published by an Australian publishing house. So it was going to be a book tour, and I booked tons of concerts now in much bigger theaters and stuff. And so on paper, things were looking great, but I was finding myself really sad about still touring and losing money, still like having to invest out of pocket to do things. And I was like, when is it going to click? Like, what more do I have to do as an artist to make this thing work? Anyway, so I was sort of like excited and also really daunted. And the other thing about it was that I knew what I was getting myself into. When I first did this in California in 2016, I knew nothing.
Yeah.
So I had that blissful naivety. But now I was like, oh my goodness, Joe, why are you doing this to yourself again? This is difficult. And it was so much further that I had to go. Longer, much higher stakes, many, many more people watching and waiting. And in Australia, the roads are way worse. You'd be, sort of surprisingly enough, there's just no infrastructure for cycling, unless you go really off-road. But because I had to connect concert venues and get to places in a certain amount of time, I had to stick with the main roads. Oh, and the other big challenge in Australia was that I went in the Australian springtime, which is nesting season for magpies, and magpies like to dive bomb cyclists. Like cyclists have had their eyes pecked out.
Oh my God.
Cyclists have been killed by magpies. Yeah, literally. I mean, this is Australia. You know, every animal there wants to kill you, and it's no joke. So I had my helmet was like this beacon of defense. I had a wide brimmed hat on underneath it. On my helmet, I had like flashing lights and zip ties, spikes, and I looked like Hellraiser gone wrong.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's funny to think back on it now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There was one scene that just really touched me. It was a very vulnerable in the documentary. You're in the middle of the woods, basically, and you stopped and you're in the bush, like you're out in the Australian bush, and you're like, I think you were scared. Like you were like, I'm out here by myself. Like there's nobody around. I'm in the middle of nowhere. And I was thinking, yeah, how vulnerable to be, you know, self-supported out in the middle of nowhere in the Australian bush. And it was just, I don't know, just the bravery of what you're undertaking, really, that was like the pinnacle for me. It was in the video, in the documentary, was like, wow, this woman has a ton of courage to do this. That was super vulnerable.
That was a pretty funny moment. And, you know, looking back on it, I realized I wasn't really in danger at all. The three bad things could have happened. Thing one, I could have gotten bitten by a snake. Yeah. That would have been bad. Or like attacked by a kangaroo. These two things highly likely didn't happen. Thing two, I could have run out of water. And thing three, I could have got a flat tire. And all those three things could have happened at the same time. But none of them did.
Thankfully.
But they crossed my mind. But I remember a goanna, this lizard, which is like 6 foot long. I didn't know goannas were so huge. And apparently goannas like to climb people because they think you're trees. So I did have a couple of goanna encounters, almost near encounters, near misses. So I was like cycling along this dirt road and these huge, like mini alligators just crossed my path and scampered up the tree and then sort of looked at me and I was like, oh my God, what's going on? But yeah, I was definitely scared, but that was another moment of like, I can't, like, I have no option. If I stop, that's the end of me, or I just keep going. You just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other. Yeah. I remember the beer that night was amazing.
I bet.
I had a cold beer and Thai food. It was a great evening.
That sounds like it. Super cool. What's coming up for you? So you got the album release. Are you doing some concerts coming up late summer in the fall? Like what's on the horizon for you musically?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. I'm doing a little backyard concert at my house in LA at the end of this month, sort of a local show celebration of the album. And then I'm going to Europe. Hooray!
Yeah.
And I'm performing in London. I'm performing at the Pizza Express in Chelsea, the jazz club there, on the 18th of October. And before that, I'm going to be in Germany performing at a classical music festival, but I'm in a town north of Berlin called Schwerin. And they actually, this town and this festival have archive my grandfather, who was a concert pianist, all of his music is there. So my family have sort of been invited often to perform at this festival, and even though I'm not a classical musician, I'm going to do some like how to improvise for classical musicians workshops and
fun.
And a concert of my own music, so that'll be nice. I've been trying, you know, I want to book more and more and get back on the wagon of concert doing. I'm ready to be busy again on stage. It's been a long time.
Right. And are you writing? Is writing something that just happens continuously for you?
No, wouldn't that be nice? I haven't written anything at all. Like for a really long time. I feel like All in Time was the last song I wrote. But I have been doing, and then I was working on the, you know, recording the album, editing it, producing it, and so on, the artwork. And but I have actually, what's been cool, I sing in a choir in LA, and they have commissioned me to arrange one of my songs, Uprise Skyward, which is on the album, for choir, because it's got many, many of my own voice. So it's essentially like a treble arrangement. So I've transcribed it and put it in for SATB. And my choir, it's like 50 singers, are going to be performing that next weekend.
Oh, beautiful.
Which is really exciting. So it's kind of been fun, actually, to get more involved creatively with ensembles where I'm not the band leader, but I'm still being asked to be super creative and compose and sing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice. Where can people find out more about you, Joe? Where are you online if they want to learn more or check out the album?
Yeah, well, I have a website, joannawalfish.com, and I do dabble in Instagram, and all my social media handles are just my full name, Joanna Walfish. Or you could sign up to my newsletter if you subscribe to my website. Then you get like semi-regular newsletters.
Awesome. Yeah. Joanna, it's been such a joy to get to know you and spend this time. I really appreciate you. You got a full plate and to take an hour and chat with me and share with my audience. I'm really grateful.
Thanks for having me. It's so nice to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, same. Okay, thanks a lot, Joanna.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode with Joanna Walfish. I had such a lovely time getting to know her and learning more about her. It was real delight to hear her stories, especially being a cyclist myself, about her riding down the west coast of the U.S. and also her great cycling tour of Australia. Really brave and adventurous person. I really, truly admire. You can check out her website to learn more about her, Joanna Walfish. That's JoannaWalfish.com. She's based out of LA and used to be in New York City, originally from the UK. And she's full-time mom as well as a musician and songwriter. She's got a lot going on. I can't wait to hear what comes next for her. Check out our website, theplayfulmusician.com. You can listen to all past episodes, see show notes, and sign up for our newsletter that goes out occasionally. Thanks again for listening. I hope you have a great week, and we'll see you back here soon.